The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2025 issue. We begin with our cover story. Dr. Drosophila. Meet Drosophila melanogaster, the tiny fly behind more than 100 years of biomedical science. If you've ever let a bunch of bananas on your counter go overripe, you have likely played host to a cloud of fruit flies. They were almost certainly unwelcome house guests, but this same species of fly could save your life one day. Fruit flies in a kitchen are a nuisance, but in a laboratory, they've proven themselves time and again to be crucial for biomedical breakthroughs. The idea that a tiny insect has anything in common with a human might seem strange, but for more than a century, the common fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, has yielded precious information about how our bodies work. In labs all around the world, fruit flies are the key to scientists learning how diseases are passed down through our genes, how cancer cells proliferate, and even how chemical impulses travel through our brains. This little fly is quite an extraordinary one, says Erica McAllister, a fly and flea curator at the Natural History Museum in London. However, there's much about fruit flies that's misunderstood. For one, the, quote, common fruit fly isn't actually a fruit fly at all, but a vinegar fly. Fruit isn't even the main part of its diet. Instead, the insect consumes yeast and sugar on decomposing fruit. To make matters more confusing, the fly's scientific name, Drosophila melanogaster, isn't technically correct either. Genetic analyses have suggested that these flies don't belong in the genus Drosophila, but rather in a separate genus called Sophophora. But the flies are so widely used in scientific research that renaming them would be a logistical nightmare. No matter what they're called, in this article, flies, fruit flies, Drosophila, and Drosophila melanogaster, these insects have guided medical science since 1901, when researchers at Harvard University decided to delve into the fledgling field of genetics with a new study subject. Drosophila made an ideal model for these early genetic studies because they're easy and inexpensive to care for, and they reproduce rapidly. A fruit fly can go from egg to larva to full-grown adult in a span of 10 days and can live up to 7 weeks. As an adult, a female fruit fly can lay up to 50 eggs per day. In 1908, geneticist Thomas Hunt Morgan at Columbia University began breeding Drosophila for scientific study, and in 1910, he reported something peculiar. Most fruit flies have bright red eyes, but in his vials, he spotted several males with white ones. In his lab, nicknamed the Fly Room, he bred several more generations of flies and produced more white-eyed individuals, all of which were male. Scientists had already known that some of the thread-like structures in the nucleus of cells, called chromosomes, were linked to an individual's sex. Male flies had an X and Y chromosome, while females had two X's. Morgan correctly postulated that the gene causing the flies to have white eyes was on the X chromosome. And as he studied more fly mutations, he demonstrated that each gene had a specific location on the chromosomes. His work on how chromosomes relate to heredity won him a Nobel Prize in 1933. Tracking genetic changes across the generations was easier, cheaper, and faster in fruit flies than in other lab animals like mice and rabbits, and was seen as more ethical, so scientists continued to use them. In 1946, Hermann Joseph Müller, one of Morgan's former students, won a Nobel Prize for showing that exposing fruit flies to the ionizing radiation of X-rays increased the likelihood of genetic mutations. Since then, four more Nobels have been awarded to researchers using Drosophila to better understand medical science. Fruit flies have only 8 chromosomes, compared to the 46 in humans, and they have around 14,000 genes, compared to our 20,000 or more. However, thanks to our shared evolutionary history, hundreds of millions of years ago, they're actually much more like us than you think, says Hugo Bellin, a professor at Baylor College of Medicine and the Neurological Research Institute of Texas Children's Hospital. Since 2015, Bellin has been the head of the Model Organism Screening Center, or MOSC, supported by the National Institute of Health's Undiagnosed Disease Network. He recalls that when he first proposed using fruit flies to screen for rare genetic diseases, he was met with skepticism. The physicians were surprised that the NIH had selected flies as a model organism, Bellin says. They raised their hands and they said, "Where are the bones? Are there lungs? Do they have a spleen?" And they were joking with me, but 6 months later, I had solved 2 cases. Bellin finds the fly versions of the genes that cause neurodegenerative diseases in humans, and then uses fly test subjects to find treatments for those diseases. When physicians have patients with an unknown illness, they do genetic testing to find the genes that may be to blame. They then ask Bellin and his team to see if there are any related genes in Drosophila called orthologs. 80% of the time, we find the fly ortholog and we can work with the fly genes, Bellin says. Using the genetic engineering technique known as CRISPR, scientists create flies with mutations in the orthologs of the identified human genes. If the flies develop similar symptoms to the humans, that's evidence that the mutated genes being targeted are indeed the cause of the human's illness. We've been able to discover more than 50 new human diseases in a few years, Bellin says. But identifying the genes associated with a disease is only half the battle. They then need to specify what mayhem the malfunctioning genes are causing on a biochemical, cellular level, and then learn how to stop it. When looking for fly genes responsible for brain cell maintenance in 2015, Bellin and his colleagues discovered that flies with a genetic defect in the energy-producing components of their brain cells developed a buildup of fatty compounds that had chemically reacted with oxygen. It turns out that about a century earlier, another scientist noticed something similar. In 1907, neuroscientist Alois Alzheimer documented lipid droplet accumulation in the brain cells of some patients, people with a disease that would later be named for him. The gene associated with this buildup of oxidized lipids is a high predictor of Alzheimer's disease in humans. Bellin's team followed up on the connection and puzzled out the series of biochemical reactions that lead to the accumulation of these oxidized fatty compounds, and even found a treatment for the affected flies, the antioxidant N-acetylcysteine amide. However, Bellin says that a human clinical trial is out of reach for now because the drug's patent is expired. That means any pharmaceutical company can produce it, making it a less attractive candidate for companies seeking to expand their profits. While drugs are one avenue to treating diseases, other researchers have turned to Drosophila to harness cellular behavior by getting healthy cells to attack their unhealthy counterparts. Billions of cells in our body die every day, says Kim McCall, a professor at Boston University. But when the instructions for cells to die and for living cells to consume those dead cells go haywire, it can result in disease. For instance, neurodegeneration can develop when too many cells die, and if cells grow unchecked, it can result in cancer. McCall experiments with cells in fruit fly ovaries to learn more about the genetic and chemical instructions for healthy cell death and consumption. She and her colleagues insert genetically engineered mutations into the fly's DNA and then examine if those genes have an effect on cell behavior. In 2016, she showed that under certain genetic and molecular conditions, the cells in the fruit fly ovary eat each other alive. This discovery caught the eye of Denise Montell, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her lab had found that a mutation to a cellular maintenance gene called RAC causes cells to destroy the tissue around themselves, possibly activating a similar process to what McCall had reported. We know RAC is required generally for cells to eat, and so we were like, huh, maybe that's what's going on, Montell says. Indeed, hyperreactive RAC was responsible for the cellular cannibalism they observed. These findings laid the groundwork for further research. We realized we might be able to harness this hyperactive eating, this cellular cannibalism, to treat cancer, Montell says. An experimental type of cancer treatment called CARM uses genetically modified cells to consume cancer cells. By supplementing traditional CARM therapy with a mutant RAC gene, they successfully targeted mouse and human cancer cells. CARM therapy tells the modified cells what to eat, Montell says, and RAC tells them to eat more of it. They published their findings in 2023, and as of 2024, the researchers were testing the combination therapy on human immune cells. However, a cancer treatment that works in an animal model doesn't always work in a human. Success rates in cancer clinical trials run around 5%, says Ross Kagan, a professor at the University of Glasgow. We keep curing our models preclinically before we get to patients, but the patients don't react the way the models do. So we really need to rethink what our models look like. For Kagan and his colleagues, that has meant creating what he calls fly avatars. Around 2012, a patient named Mark Beninga with difficult-to-treat cancer approached Kagan and asked to have his tumor genetically sequenced in contribution to cancer research. The whole avatar idea basically got hatched right there, Kagan says. Mark completely inspired this because I realized we're going to sequence it, and then what are we going to do with all that information? And it had occurred to me, hey, fruit flies. Inspired by Beninga, who passed away in 2014, Kagan and his colleagues created a clinical trial in which they sequenced the mutations present in the patient's tumors and created genetically modified fruit flies with the fly equivalent of those mutations. This could only be done in flies, Kagan says, because flies provided the right combination of biological complexity and quick reproduction that allowed him to create a large enough cohort to study. He and his team bred hundreds of thousands of flies for each patient who were avatars of patients' cancers and began testing treatments. We screened every FDA-approved drug available, he says. The researchers found combinations of drugs tailored to each participant in the clinical trial. While some patients showed some success with some of the treatments found, the trial was stopped due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We had to shut the whole thing down, Kagan says. The good news, however, is that the study gave birth to Vivin. Vivin Therapeutics is a biomedical startup based in London that has picked up the torch of the work begun by Kagan and his colleagues. As far as I know, we are the only company in the world using Drosophila to do this type of translational biomedical research, says Naul Villegas, Vivin's chief science officer. Recently, Vivin's researchers have pivoted from racing to treat individual terminal cancer patients to developing a broader base of knowledge of different possible treatments. We analyzed thousands of different tumors, specifically colorectal tumors, and we identified all the potential molecular profiles associated with this tumor type, all the combinations and configurations of different genetic alterations involved in every tumor, Villegas says. The researchers identified 400 different molecular profiles. That means that colorectal cancer is at least 400 different diseases. A better understanding of the specific subtypes of cancer that patients have, coupled with information from fruit flies about which drugs work best to treat those specific cancers, could one day make precision cancer treatments available to many more people. Flies' genes and cells aren't the only parts of them that bear similarities to humans. There are entire organs in our bodies that are comparable. One of the most important ones is the brain. We understood really well how the heart pumps blood. We understand how each cell type works together with other cell types to make the heart pump blood, and how it pumps differently depending on how fast you're running, for example, says Rachel Wilson, a professor at Harvard Medical School. We don't really understand how different cell types in the brain work together to perform really detailed, intricate, fast computations. So one approach to this is to focus on fruit flies. A fruit fly's brain is about the size of a poppy seed. However, they're a lot more intelligent than we give them credit for, McAllister says. Fruit flies' brains process information provided by their powerful sense of smell, and they put this information to good use by squeezing under doors and barely open windows in search of food. And, perhaps most charmingly, Drosophila sing to each other, McAllister says. They vibrate their wings to a certain pitch, the males, to sing to the ladies, which I think is really cute. In 2024, researchers announced that they'd created a complete fruit fly brain connectome, a wiring diagram showing how all the brain cells or neurons are connected to each other via synapses. It's the first complete connectome for any organism with a true brain, and creating it involved years of painstaking work. The scientists started with a single fly brain that had been partitioned into 7,000 almost impossibly thin slices, which were then imaged using an electron microscope. Researchers used machine learning to put these slices together into one 3D map, helping to correct for the distortions where each slice was made, and doing the grunt work of identifying the structures that they were interested in. Then, countless person hours went into refining the map to show each of the fly brain's nearly 140,000 neurons and the 50 million synapses connecting them. If you are interested in the function of a specific neuron, well, now you know which neuron synapse into it, so which ones you have to go and measure as well if you want to, for instance, relate its function to other neurons, says Sven Dorkenwald, a research fellow at the Allen Institute and the University of Washington, who helped create the connectome. It kind of lifts the fog that was there before. While the human brain is far more complex than a fly's, with billions of neurons and trillions of synapses, the structural similarities between the two allow for valuable comparisons. The connectome may also serve as a tool for understanding how a brain works on the whole, as more than the sum of its parts. For a long time, theorists of neuroscience have just had to basically make educated guesses about how brains might be structured to support the many computations that brains are capable of doing. Even a simple brain, like a fly brain, says Albert Lin, a fellow at Princeton University's Center for the Physics of Biological Function, who also worked on the connectome. Now we finally have a brain that we can look at and pose these questions to. The fruit fly brain connectome is from one individual fly, long dead, but scientists use the connectome as a roadmap for their experimental work in living flies. We start the wiring diagram, and that creates hypotheses about what brain cells could be doing what jobs. And in order to test those hypotheses, it's really useful to watch brain cells in action, Wilson says. To do this, researchers use genetic tools to make some of a fly's brain cells glow so they can see which parts of the brain are active. But then it's not enough to just sort of watch brain activity sort of flicker in the brain. The animal also needs to be doing something that we as scientists can understand, Wilson says. When Wilson and her team set out to study the brain activity of flies moving through their environment, the fly's size presented a challenge. With large animals, you can implant electrodes in their brain. You can even mount tiny little microscopes on their head. But with flies, they're just too small to do any of those things, Wilson says. So instead, she and her team created an experimental setup where a fly's head was fixed in place and observed with an external microscope and electrodes. Then, to trick the stuck-in-place fly's brain into behaving as if it were moving, scientists created a fruit fly virtual reality system. We put a fly on a spherical treadmill, and then we used the movement of the spherical treadmill under the fly to adjust a virtual reality environment around the fly. We can get the fly to think that it's walking around in a spatial environment, And then we can watch how it interacts with the environment as a way of understanding what it's trying to do and why, Wilson says. Then we can correlate that behavior with the activity of specific brain cells to try to understand how those brain cells are supporting the fly's behavior and thought. Some of Wilson's experiments involve seeing how Drosophila brains respond to disorientation, which is surprisingly relevant to human medicine. It's actually very useful, then, for beginning to think about neurological and psychiatric disorders, she says. Understanding what's happening on a nuts and bolts level with a disoriented brain could be a key foundation for finding treatments. I think it's only then that we're going to be able to design and troubleshoot medications that are going to give people more relief, she says. While fruit fly research programs have spent the last century pushing science forward, Drosophila also helped to engage the next generation of scientists. Alana O'Reilly, an associate professor at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, has led a community science nonprofit called eClose since 2019. O'Reilly, whose research focuses on how diet affects stem cell function, works with students in the greater Philadelphia area to design fruit fly research projects tailored to their own lives and interests. They incorporate different foods and substances into the fly's diet and see how flies with different genetic mutations respond. Instead of following a more traditional scientific education model, in which students reproduce experiments with known results and are graded on their success or failure, O'Reilly says that students are more engaged with the open-ended, question-oriented approach of eClose. When Gabriel Vaughn participated in eClose the summer after he graduated high school, he didn't see himself pursuing a career in science. Vaughn designed this project around lean, a street drug made with cough syrup, and its effects on the brain. O'Reilly and her colleagues hadn't even heard of the drug, much less tested its effects on flies, leaving Vaughn in uncharted territory. He observed the cough syrup-fed flies, taking note of things like how quickly they moved and how often they groomed themselves, and found that flies with a specific genetic mutation associated with cell development and communication seemed to suffer more adverse effects than the control group. What really captivated me was that I was able to address a problem that didn't have a solution to it, and I was able to give a solution, says Vaughn, who has gone on to major in biology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He draws a parallel between the scientific importance of seemingly insignificant fruit flies and the potential of students and community scientists to contribute meaningfully to research. Fruit flies can be used to save the world, as minuscule as fruit flies are, Vaughn says. You also, yourself, with the little experience you have, can do that. How animals experience an eclipse. The total solar eclipses in 2017 and 2024 presented scientists with a fresh opportunity to understand the unusual reactions of animals during astronomical phenomena. For centuries, people have noticed that when the sky darkens during a solar eclipse, some animals behave strangely. Records from the 16th century mention birds ceasing to sing and even falling to the ground during eclipses. But until recently, scientific studies that provided quantitative information about how eclipses affect animals were few and far between. The total solar eclipses that crossed North America in August 2017 and April 2024 gave biologists a rare chance to examine how eclipses affect animal behavior. On average, a total solar eclipse happens somewhere on Earth every 18 months, but a given spot on the globe will be in a total eclipse's path just a few times in a millennium. The proximity of the 2017 and 2024 eclipses, in time and in place, was a boon to scientists hoping to build data sets and replicate experiments. In both eclipses, Andrew Farnsworth, a visiting scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, used weather surveillance radar to track broad patterns in the movement of animals through the atmosphere. The biological activity definitely dipped, he says. His team observed birds and insects descending from the sky as if night was approaching. However, they didn't see nocturnal behaviors, like nighttime migrations, switch on. The eclipse was enough to shut down the daytime behaviors on these broad scales, but it wasn't enough to initiate the classic nocturnal ones, Farnsworth says. Jennifer Ceruta, an assistant professor at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, studied the behavior of honeybees during the 2017 and 2024 eclipses. Her team removed bees from their hives and tracked how quickly they returned home before, during, and after each eclipse. While the male drones made a beeline for their hives during the 2017 totality, the female workers were actually a little bit more hesitant, Ceruta says, and slower to return home. In 2017, she also found that honeybees were less likely to leave their hives during an eclipse, but in hives with lots of young that needed to be fed, the workers still ventured out. Future studies might examine what about an eclipse actually affects animals' behavior. It's not just the amount of light that changes, Ceruta says. The animals might be responding to changes in temperature or humidity. Adam Hartstone Rose, a professor at North Carolina State University, found another potential factor in some animals' eclipse behavior, the humans around them. He led studies on zoo animals in the 2017 and 2024 eclipses. During the 2017 eclipse, he found that some animals headed to their enclosures as if it were nighttime, but others, like a giraffe galloping around its paddock, showed signs of anxiety. In 2024, his team observed giraffes again and found that the giraffes really seemed to be reacting not to the eclipse itself, but to the people's reaction to the eclipse, Hartstone Rose says. Crowds of exuberant eclipse watchers, rather than changes in the sky, seemed to put the giraffes on edge. While total eclipses are a relatively rare occurrence, studying them does have a place in the big picture, Farnsworth says. Anytime you can study animal behavior at big scales and see the impact of some kind of stimulus on their behavior, I think it's important to add something to our understanding. Past studies have demonstrated how certain animals behave differently during an eclipse. In 1969, scientists observed the increasing locomotion of an antelope squirrel during and after a partial solar eclipse in response to changing light levels. During the 1991 total solar eclipse, orb-weaving spiders in Mexico were also seen acting strangely, taking down their webs during totality and rebuilding them when the sun appeared. Another study found that the same eclipse impacted ectothermic or cold-blooded cicadas in Arizona, as a drop in radiative heat had caused the bugs to cease their calls once the sun was 50% covered. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.